The difference between half a mile and 5 miles is great. If the prophets of Lick Observatory did not take refraction into consideration, all the rest of their supposed knowledge may be attributable to incompetence. This difference may mean that the moon is not more than a day's journey away from this earth. In The Earth and the Stars, p. 211, Abbott tells of the spectroscopic determinations, by which the new star in Perseus, February 22, 1901, was found to be at a distance of 300 light-years from this earth. The news was published in the newspapers. A new star had appeared, about the year 1600, and its light was not seen upon this earth, until February 22, 1901. And the astronomers were able to tell this that away back, at a moment when Queen Elizabeth, well, whatever she was doing, maybe it wouldn't be any too discreet to inquire into just what she was doing, but the astronomers told that just when Queen Elizabeth was doing whatever she was doing, the heavens were doing a new star. And where am I, comparatively? Where are my poor, little yarns of flows of methylated spirits from ceilings, and mysterious strangers, and bodies on railroad lines, compared with a yarn of the new star and Queen Elizabeth? But the good, little star restores my conceit. In the face of all spectroscopes in all observatories, it shot out nebulous rings that moved at a rate of 2 or 3 seconds of arcade a day. If they were 300 light-years away, this was a velocity far greater than that of light is said to be. If they were 300 light-years away, it was motion at the rate of 220,000 miles a second. There were dogmas that could not stand this, and the spectroscopic determinations, which were in agreement, were another case of agreements working out, as they shouldn't have worked out. The astronomers had to cut down one of their beloved immensities. Whether as a matter of gallantry, or not, they spread a denial for Queen Elizabeth's reputation to tread upon, saving that from the mud of an inquiry into just what Her Majesty was doing, and substituting unromantic speculations upon what, say, Andrew Jackson was up to. Abbott's way of explaining the mistake is by attributing the first pronouncements to the roughness of the observations. All over this earth, astronomers were agreeing in these determinations. They were refinements until something else appeared and roughened them. It would seem that, after this fiasco of the readjusted interest in what historical personages were doing, astronomers should have learned something. But, if Professor Todd is right, in his characterization of them, that is impossible. About 20 years later, this situation, essentially the same in all particulars, repeated. Upon May 27, 1925, a new star was discovered in the southern constellation Pictor. By spectroscopic determination, its distance was determined to be 540 light-years. See this stated in a bulletin of the Harvard Observatory, November, 1927. March 27, 1928, the new star split. When the split was seen, astronomers of the South African Observatory repudiated the gospel of their spectroscopes of 3 years before. There must have been much roughness, even though there had been 3 years in which to plane down the splinters. They cut the distance from 540 to 40 light-years. If there should be any more reductions like this, there may start a slump of immensities down toward a conception of a thinkable-sized formation of stars. A distance cut down 60x60x24x365x500x186,000 miles is a pretty good start. Professor Einstein, having no means of doing anything of the kind, predicts a displacement of the stars. Astronomers go out upon an expedition to observe an eclipse, and, not knowing that Einstein has no special means of predicting anything, they report, presumably because they want so to report, that he is right. Then eclipse after eclipse and Einstein is wrong. But he has cast an ancient system into internal dissensions, and has cast doubts upon antiquities of thought almost as if his pedantic guesses had had better luck. Whether the time has come, or not, here is something that looks as if it is coming. An editorial in the New York Sun, September 3, 1930, views of somebody else quoted. The public is being played upon and utterly misled by the dreamery of the rival mathematical astronomers and physicists, not to mention the clerics who are raising the game of notoriety to a fine art, in rivalry to religious mysticism. A scientific pornography is being developed, and attracts the more because it is mysterious. These are the views of Professor Henry E. Armstrong, emeritus head of the Department of Chemistry at City and Guilds College, South Kensington, London. This is revolt inside. That is what develops into revolution. Professor Armstrong's accusation of pornography may seem unduly stimulating, but, judging by their lectures in other respects, one sees that all that the astronomers have to do is to discover that stars have sex, and they'll have us sneaking to bookstores for salacious pronouncements and determinations upon the latest celestial scandals. This would popularize them. And after anything becomes popular, then what? That the time has come or is coming or more of the revolt within. Or that, if they cannot continue upon their present pretenses of progress, the astronomers must return from their motionless excursions. A generation ago, they told of inconceivable distances of stars. Then they said that they had, 1,000 times, multiplied some of these distances, but, if the inconceivable be multiplied any number of times, it is still the same old inconceivability. If, at the unthinkable, thought stops, but if thought must move somewhere, the astronomers, who cannot go on expansively, will, if they do think, have to think in reductions. If the time has come, there will be a crash in the observatories, with astronomers in a panic selling short on inconceivabilities. Upon September 2, 1930, began a meeting of the American Astronomical Society, in Chicago. A paper that was read by Dr. P. Van de Kamp may be a signal for a panic. Said he, some of the stars may actually be thousands of light years nearer than astronomy believes them to be. That with some extensions is about what I am saying. Says the astronomer Leverrier, back in times when an astronomical system is growing up, and is of use in combating an older and decaying orthodoxy, and needs support and prestige, says he, look in the sky, and at the point of my calculations, you will find the planet that is perturbing Uranus. Lo, as some of the astronomers say in their books. At a point in the sky that can be said to anybody who does not inquire into the statements to be almost exactly the point of Leverrier's calculations, is found the planet Uranus, to which for all the public knows can be attributed the perturbations of Uranus. Up goes the useful renown of the astronomers. Supported by this triumph, they function. But, if they're only the figments of one of the dreamlike developments of our pseudo-existence, they, too, must pass away, and they must go by way of slaughter, or by way of laughter. Considering all their doings, I think that through hilarity would be the fitter exit. Later. Look at the sky, we are told that the astronomer Lowell said, and at the point of my calculations, you will find the planet that is perturbing Neptune. But this is in the year 1930. Nevertheless, we are told that a planet is found almost exactly at the point of the calculations. The exaltations of the astronomers are spread-headed. But this is later. The damned thing takes a tack that shows that it could no more have been perturbing Neptune than I, anyway just at present, could cast a meeting of the National Academy of Sciences into disorder by walking past it. They must be murdered, or we shall laugh them away. There is always something that can be said in favor of murder, but in the case of the astronomers that would be willful waste of the stuff for laughter. Orthodox astronomers have said that Leverrier used no mathematical method by which he could have determined the position of Neptune. See Lowell's The Evolution of Worlds, p. 124. By way of stuff for the laugh, I mention that one of these disbelieving astronomers was Lowell. One time, in a mood of depression, I went to the New York Public Library, and feeling a want for a little, light reading, I put in a slip for Lowell's memoir on a trans-Neptunian planet. I got even more amusement than I had expected. Just where was this point, determined by Lowell, almost exactly in which his planet was found? The spreadheads, the special articles over and over in the newspapers of the world, almost exactly. Says Lowell, page 105, precise determination of its place does not seem possible. A general direction alone is predicible. The stuff for a laugh that is as satisfactory as murder is in the solemn announcements, by the astronomers, about April Fool's Day, 1930, that they had found Lowell's planet almost exactly in the place, precise determination of which does not seem possible. Their chatter over Lowell's magnificent accuracy in pointing in a general direction. Then the tack of a thing that showed that it could not have been all this indefiniteness, anyway. 265 years, instead of 3,000 years. And instead of going, the thing was coming. If they can't tell whether something is coming or going, their solemn announcements upon nearness or farness may be equally laughable. If by mathematical means Adams and Le Verrier did not determine the position of the planet Neptune, or if it was, in an opinion that Lowell quotes, a happy accident, how account for such happiness, or for this timely and sensational boost to a prestige, if we suspect that it was not altogether an accident? My expression is that herein I typify my idea of organic control which, concealed under human vanity, makes us think that we are doing all things ourselves, gives support to human institutions, when they are timely and are functioning, and then casts its favorites into rout and fiasco, when they have outlived their functioning period.